We Talk Podcasts is now proudly presented by Geek Nation Tours. The zombie apocalypse is imminent. Could you survive? You'll have a better chance after completing Geek Nation Tours Zombie Apocalypse Training 101. Learn to fire weapons, scrounge for food, and actually run from zombies. The time of the geek is at hand. Geek Nation Tours provides fun and unique vacation packages featuring themes such as the Civil War, Harry Potter, board games and beer, sports geeks, in locations such as Germany, Japan, England, and all over America. Visit geeknationtours.com and get your geek on.
Hey yo, welcome to an episode of We Talk Comics. This is a super special episode. I got Mo with me, I'm Brett, and we'd like to welcome writer of The Avengers, Captain America, Detective Comics, Doctor Strange, Green Lantern, Justice League, Coyote, everything, you name it, the legendary Steve Englehart. How are you doing, Steve?
I'm good. How are you guys?
Great.
You didn't introduce me as the legendary Mo.
Sorry. The legendary Mo.
Thank you. Steve, thank you very much for taking the time here. We were just talking a little bit off the air there about your comic book collection. And it's one of the things that actually kind of interests me when I read your work is that you've so often brought back characters that were kind of gone for a while that obviously you had some idea for. And after you brought them back, they've kind of never gone away again. And is that something that you kind of taken, I don't know, a character like a Deadshot or Dr. Hugo Strange, obviously, in your Batman run is a good example.
Yeah, well, I did. I read everything I could get my hands on. When I was a fan, we were saying off the air, I started as a fan back when comics were not yet a thing. So they weren't real expensive, and there, you know, wasn't that far back I had to go. So to me, comics consisted of everything comics, everything that was being published now, all the, you know, spirit stuff from the past, you know, all everything. And most of it stayed in my brain. I mean, it all just sort of became part of what I thought comics was about. So when I started writing comics, you know, I'd be plotting things out and I could draw from all of that. And, you know, Marvel had made a big deal about continuity and that it was all one universe and so on and so forth. So it was, I didn't have to twist anybody's arm if I thought, you know, let's bring in Patsy Walker or let's bring in, you know, whoever. By the time I got to Batman, it was just a matter of course to do that. But yeah, I like all of comics and tried to reflect that, I guess.
Now, a lot of the newer comic book writers, especially some of the larger ones, you know, Brian Michael Bendis, Geoff Johns, and Jonathan Hickman have used the same kind of concept of going back into the comic history and really bringing, you know, characters and scenarios up to fit the new storylines that they're doing. So do you think that you kind of influenced that? Was there many people when you were writing who were doing the same kind of thing that you were?
No, I mean, I hesitate to be categorical about it because I haven't really thought about it, but I don't think that there were. I don't recall other people doing that. So either I was the only one or I was a leading proponent of that kind of thing. So I would assume that people doing it afterwards when it wasn't being done before was something that was influenced. That's a very passive aggressive way. Probably, yeah, but, you know, I don't know.
Now, one of the things that actually, when we talked to Bob Layton, that he said to us, and I can't remember who it was that said it to him, maybe Brett will remember, but somebody told him, when you become a comic book creator, you can't be a fan anymore. You're either a professional or you're a reader. You know, you're either a fan or you're a creator. You can't be both. What do you think about that?
Well, I know what he's saying. You have to actually deliver the goods at the end of the day. You can't just go, wow, this is so much fun. I'm having a great time. But I don't see any reason why you can't deliver the goods and have a good time. I mean, that's what I basically did. I really liked the whole process of writing comics within limits. Got to take a little side trip there. As you may know, I did comics for like 6-7 years at a crack, and then I took 6-7 years off in between, and then came back, and then went off. When I was getting started in comics, in fact, before I was even in comics, I was friends with Dick Giordano, and he said to me one day, he was still working at Charlton in those days. He was the editor at Charlton, but he also inked, and he said that he was really glad he was an inker, because inkers could just sit there with the TV on all day long and ink, whereas writers inevitably burn themselves out, and that made an impression on me. So I've said in other contexts, the great thing about writing comics was that there was a new story every week, and the bad thing about writing comics was there was a new story every week, you know? When I would get to the point when I'd go, yeah, no, this is not becoming fun anymore, this is not fun, then I would, you know, go off and do something else. I designed games, I wrote children's books, I mean, all these other things that I did. But in those periods before it became the time for my brain to turn to cheese, I really liked, the good thing was a new story every week, I tried to deliver the goods. I mean, I always looked at it as like, I knew when I was a fan, before I got into being a pro, I knew what I liked reading, you know? When Roy Thomas would write something that I really liked, I would go, yeah, I like that. Or Stan, or, you know, or the guys at DC or Tower Comics, you know, whatever. So in the back of my brain pretty much all the time was like, I want these guys to get something out of this book, to really like, you know, to find something likable. And I guess my tastes, you know, overlapped with a lot of people's, because what I found likable, they found likable. But so I know what Bob's saying. You can't just, you know, show up and say, okay, now I'm writing comics, it's all good. You actually have to do the work, but the work doesn't have to be that far removed from being a fan, I don't think.
Well, and in your case, you were writing so many of the titles. I would think that you would need to kind of, you know, be up to date on everything else that was going on, because your series, I mean, especially in those early days, I mean, they all crossed over extremely well with each other, and you were writing a lot. I don't even know how you managed to keep up with all of that volume.
Well, again, I was young. I was getting my shot at something I really wanted to do. Comics were extremely fun at that point in time. You know, I mean, everything made it very easy to do that. And I liked holding the whole universe in my head. I mean, in those days, again, both Marvel and DC supplied everybody who was working for either of those companies with all the books for free. So, you know, everybody at Marvel got all the DC books for free, and all the Marvel books, obviously. And I read them, you know, I liked comics. So, and I retained them, you know, to the extent that when called upon, I had a pretty good working knowledge of pretty much everybody. And that was just part of the deal. When I came back to Marvel for the last time in the early 2000s, they asked me to do a 3-part miniseries with Norm Breyfogle about Hellcat. And that's Patsy Walker, who I had brought back in The Beast and then in The Avengers and all that. And they said, you know, since you've been gone, she married the son of Satan, committed suicide. You know, it's like, oh, okay, well, I didn't know. And so I said to the editor, Tom Brevoort, I said, you know, I'm really sorry that I don't know all the stuff that's happened over the last X number of years while I wasn't in comics. And he said, well, no writer does anymore. It's all up to the editors now to know that stuff. I guess that's true. But in my day, it was up to the writers. Each writer was pretty much an independent entity. It had to, you know, go past Marvel editorial, which consisted of Roy Thomas and somebody like me, or, you know, I mean, some secondary person. But I mean, Marvel was not heavy into editing. It was pretty much, you know, what you did was what showed up on the stands, which I loved. But it was incumbent upon each and every writer to pretty much know their character and their world and so forth. And so we all operated carrying the world around in our head.
So what kind of, you know, just from any burgeoning writers out there, what kind of tips would you give them, especially if they want to write in comics and write volume? Because I know that one of the biggest things is to be able to maintain, you know, the timelines.
Well, I don't know that it's that big anymore because they keep rebooting everything, and and most people sort of write 6-issue miniseries that can be collected later. I mean, there's a whole different approach to stuff now. I mean, Bendis is the obvious counter to that, but I mean, most people don't write. You know, I mean, I did 4 years of Captain America, 4 or 5 years of the Avengers, and another, you know, 3 or 4 years of the West Coast. I mean, you know, to me, again, coming in the era that I came in, you got a book, you were going to do that book for, you know, for the foreseeable future. It wasn't a short-term deal. So the requirements today, I think, are different. And, you know, I mean, we're just jumping around here, but I mean, the reason that I don't do comics today is because I'm not a big fan of the way that they're done today. I'd rather be the guy with all the responsibility on my shoulders and the entire universe in my head and just go out and let it rip. And these days, again, the editor, I mean, to do a series these days, you pretty much have to like say, okay, Mr. Editor, here's what I want to do. And then he'll say, you can't do that part. Here's what you can do. And then you go away and you come back and you go, okay, well, within the thing that's left, I think I'll go in this direction. And he says, well, you can do that, but you can't do that. And by the time you've worked all that out, then they want to know what you're going to do for the first 12 issues. And that would just be, I'd have to blow my brains out if I was in that situation, because I really like to let the stories develop organically. Because if it's all in my head, I'm not going to lose anything. I can deal with it. If I were to tell you now what's in issue number 12, and I actually was forced to stay on that path, which I wouldn't want to do in the first place, but if I was forced to do that, and I finally, a year later, I get to issue 12, and I'm writing something that I thought of a year earlier, and it's like, you know, that's not, and none of that is appealing to me. So I don't know that I can give much help in terms of doing comics today, but I mean, I would just go back to saying, if you really like comics, I mean, because again, everybody gets his own era, and I'm sure that if you were in the early 20s like I was, and you really wanted to do comics, and Marvel Comics or DC Comics said, hey, you can write Hawkman, I would assume that you'd be pretty happy with that, and they would say, here are the rules, and you'd go, sure. That's the other thing I think about, you know, whenever you get your first job, or any job, they say, yeah, good, you're hired. Now, here are the rules. And you don't go, well, okay, but I want to renegotiate that. You just go, no, I'm, you know, thank you for hiring me. I'll do whatever, you know, whatever. And so you learn to play by whatever the rules there are. And I'm sure that people getting into comics today who, you know, I'm sure they've heard about how it used to be, but they're not there, and they're here. So I would assume that people, you know, find a way to make that system work for them. But I would just say, have a good time and you know, you deliver the goods. I mean, that's whatever the goods are that they want, you have to deliver them, and hopefully you can have a good time doing it. But I don't have any more sage advice than that.
No, I think that's good advice still. Let's go back then to kind of when you started a little bit more then, and you're working for Marvel. Well, I guess you're obviously, that's not where you started. I guess you were, you know, working with Neil Adams. You wanted to be an artist.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And, but when you got to Marvel, I mean, I think there's a perception that, that there was a lot of chaos going around Marvel, and it wasn't nearly as much fun as people hoped it was. But maybe that isn't the case. Like, I think because there were so many different editors-in-chiefs in a short period of time in the 70s and seemed to be a change of ownership and that type of thing. But, you mean, you were hanging out with other creators, weren't you, often?
Yeah. And so I immediately rejected your initial premise, but then you were sort of going on over a longer period of time. So, I mean, things did change over a period of time. When I got there in 1972... It was not chaotic, and it was fun. It was definitely a bullpen. It was a small group of people putting out all these books. But everybody was loving it. I don't recall people having a problem with it. Then by the mid 70s, when Roy stopped being the editor in chief, and then I forget whether Len was first and Marv was second or the other way around, but they both did it for a short amount of time. And then Jerry Conway did it for like 3 weeks. And then Archie Goodwin, I think, sort of got it for a little while, but eventually they settled on Jim Shooter. And Shooter, I think by that time there had been some, I wouldn't say chaos, but I think things had gotten sloppy because of all the different, the changes. You know, there wasn't this... I had moved to California by that time, so I didn't see any of this firsthand. And in fact, I'd left Marvel by the time. Well, I left Marvel after Conway became the editor, so I never saw Shooter in his original incarnation. But I mean, Shooter made a big deal out of getting all the trains to run on time, and I'm guessing then that there was some chaos in regards to the trains, and he had to do that. And I think in instituting a more rigorous editorial regime, he probably made it less fun for some people. I wasn't there, so I can't say. In the first half of the 70s, it was the best place in the world to work, I thought. You know, I loved it.
Jim Shooter seems to me to be a very an enigma to a lot of us fans. We're not really sure, we're not really sure about him, like, because he is obviously his influences. We can see reading the books underneath him editorially are the ones I grew up on and I enjoyed and I loved. And yet, you know, I hear a lot of people complaining about him within the industry. And I'm not really sure. I mean, how would you describe Jim Shooter? Can you describe Jim Shooter?
Yeah, well, he comes up with rules and he's very rigid about sticking with them. Again, I think he's very structured, which was good for what Marvel needed at that time. The problem is, there's two problems. One, he had a hard time being flexible about those rules. When I came back in the 80s and encountered him at that point in time, he had a fairly fearsome reputation as a guy who would take, it was his way or the highway. And he had a rule, for example, there was a rule that you couldn't use the word supervillain because nobody in real life said the word supervillain. And because I wasn't afraid of him, I was new and if he fired me, I could go to DC and do Green Lantern. I didn't confront him, but I sat down with him and I said, Jim, in the real world, nobody says the word supervillain, but in the Marvel world, there's guys who knock over liquor stores and there's guys who want to destroy the world. People would come up with a word to describe those two different types of things. And he could see the logic in that. And so after that, we got to use the word supervillain. So, I mean, I found him reasonable to talk to. The second thing, though, is a little more problematic in that... a lot of people said that he would just decide he didn't like you and then he would make your life miserable. And that never happened to me at Marvel. when they fired him and replaced him with Tom DeFalco, several people at Marvel said he was gearing up for you. He was getting ready to come after you. So that may or may not be true, and it, you know, and who knows what it would have been. But he did have a again, that sort of rigidity that if you got on his bad side, he would make your life tough and not, you know, just in an authoritarian way. You know, he's a complicated guy. Later, I worked for him at Valiant, he came to me and asked me, would I write XO? He was supposed to write it, but would I write it? And write it in his style, because he thought one of his rules was Marvel had been successful because Stan Lee wrote everything, so it all sounded the same. So at Valiant, he wanted everything to sound the same. But he said, I'm going to be flexible about that with you, so if you'll write XO in my style, then when you create this book you're going to do called Shadow Man, you can write it the way you want to write it. And so I wrote 3 or 4 issues of XO for him, and then I wrote Shadow Man, and then he came to me, and he was really torn, and he said, you know, I told you you could, but I can't do it. He says, I really think everything needs to sound the same, and this doesn't sound like me, and I just, you know, and here's the thing. He said, you can tell people that story. You can tell them that I told you you could do it and then had to back off because that's what I feel. I thought, well, all right, again, within the context of a complicated guy, that's an honorable way of approaching it. And so I have told that story, you know, when the subject has come up over the years. And the final point on that was about 2 years ago, apparently he gave some interview in which he said, I fired Steve because he couldn't do this or that or the other thing. And I thought, well, that's really disappointing. You know, you know, I don't want to attribute a motive, but I, you know, for some reason he felt the need to back off what he'd been before. So there's your answer. I mean, he's a complicated guy. Not all bad, not all good. But I mean, the hallmark is the rules. The hallmark is the idea that he's looked at it and he's figured out the answer, and that's the only answer. Getting him off that is difficult.
Now, you mentioned Tom DeFalco, and when I first met you, it was doing the Marvel bullpen panel at the Edmonton Expo with Tom DeFalco and Arvell Jones. Now, I want to know, like, how difficult, because you and Tom DeFalco were kind of in separate bullpen eras, really. Right. And so, you know, did that panel kind of make sense to you? How did you feel about it? Because you were almost talking about different things.
Well, we were. I mean, we were, just as you said, we were in different eras. He, you know, I knew him, you know, as a writer, and not all that well as a writer before he became the editor-in-chief, and when he became the editor-in-chief, fairly quickly, we did not see eye to eye, and so I left Marvel again at that point. I don't think Tom and I could claim, either one of us would claim that we're great friends. On the other hand, we sat next to each other all weekend at Edmonton, and we didn't kill anybody, you know? I mean, it's like, well, you know. But I mean, you know, his era really begins in like 1989. I'm not even sure how long he was the editor in chief, somewhere into the 90s. But I mean, and my era, you know, a good chunk of the 70s, good chunk of the 80s, and 89 is, you know, when I left Marvel again. So, I thought the, you know, but I thought, I mean, the Arvell had his own take on you know, his time there. So I thought it was a good panel. But it, you know, it if you'd had me and Jim Starlin and Frank Brunner and Steve Gerber, if he were around, I mean, you know, people from that era, we undoubtedly would have a more coherent output than the three of us who were there. But I didn't have a problem with the panel.
Yeah, I'd love to see that panel. that'd be something else. You know, some of these people, one of the things is you were an associate editor. Is that what you were when you first got your first job there?
Something like that.
Writer?
Yeah, something like associate that. Or assistant or whatever it
something
was.
Something like that.
Bottom of the totem pole, whatever it was, yeah.
And, I mean, you were there and you just kind of had the job kind of like an opportunity thrown at you to write, what is it, Adventures or something like that?
The Beast.
The Beast.
Adventures of the Beast?
Yeah, Adventures.
Yeah. Well,
I was
on staff. I was still thinking I was going to be an artist. And then Gary Friedrich had a 6-page monster story that he didn't feel like writing. So he sent it back to the office and said, get somebody else to do this. And they kind of looked around and said, you, low totem pole guy, you want to write this thing? And I'm like, sure. You know, I mean, yeah. And I had a good time writing it, and they liked it too. So they said, well, you want to do some more writing? And I said, okay. So in those days, Marvel was still publishing romance books and Western books and monster books. And so new writers would generally sort of write in those genres before they could graduate to the superhero books. So I did a couple romance stories. I did some Westerns, you know. I wrote a couple more monster stories, and by that time they said, okay, now you can start on this low-level, obscure, failed character called the Beast. And again, I had a great time every time I sat down to write, and they liked what I was doing, so they kept offering me more. And so the whole art thing just sort of fell by the wayside. But yeah, I mean, it's just right place, right time. And the fact that there were so many books, I mean, they were publishing a lot of books with a limited number of people. And I used to tell people, used to be that you had to physically go to New York to get into comics, because it was before the internet and before FedEx and before all that stuff. You had to be able to take stuff and give stuff and so forth. And I would tell people when they, you know, when they'd ask, I'd say, well, the first thing you got to do is move to New York. If you can do that, then that's the hard part, because if you go up there and show them that you're interested and show them a sample that looks like something they might like, I guarantee you within a couple of months, you'll get a call saying so-and-so missed his deadline on this particular book. Can you write a fill-in or something? You know, I mean, that was the way it worked. I mean, you'd get your shot in a fairly short amount of time because there was always somebody who missed a deadline, and they would always be somebody who could, you know, who could fill in. And then it was just a case of, do they like what you're doing? You know,
what's amazing to me is you hear about all the people that were kind of low on the totem pole like that there. And, you know, yourself and Bill Mantlow and Chris Claremont, and, you know, he wanted to be an actor, but, you know, got the opportunities kind of thrown at him. And it's these legendary writers who all seem to almost, like, say, right place, right time, almost lucked into this. And yet the talent level of these people is just, is there something, I don't know, what do you think just drew people all kind of that talent level, that mindset kind of drew them together there?
Stan Lee and his and all Jack Kirby, and I mean, you know, the whole Marvel thing. I mean, you know, the people I mentioned a couple minutes ago, Gerber and Brunner and Weiss and Starlin and all that, we were all the same age, and we had all sort of spent the last 10 years reading comics and getting old enough to where we could do comics. And so we all kind of came in at the same time. We were all excited about the Marvel comic universe, about, you know, Marvel was, I said, when I got into comics in 66, Marvel was a thing, but it wasn't a big thing really, where you had to, like, but by the early 70s, it was a pretty big thing. There was, you know, The books were big hits on college campuses. They were, you know, but they were still under the Comics Code, so you could be 6 years old or 60 years old, and you could read them and get into them. So I think there were just a bunch of us who, I mean, I don't know why we were all sort of exactly the same age. And of course, Claremont was younger, and I mean, you know, we weren't all exactly, but there were a bunch of us who were all pretty much the same age. And we all just sort of came out and said, this is what we want to do. We jumped into a very exciting period. And I think because we wanted to do it, we wanted to be, we didn't want to, like, you know, let anybody down at that point. So it was, I mean, Marvel really felt like, and it was complete creative freedom too. I mean, you know, if you had an interest, if you got a shot, there was nobody saying, stop here, don't do that, tailor that a little bit. It was like you could have complete access to your imagination. And so, again, a lot of fun. Why everybody came at the same time, that I can't exactly say, but it just, I mean, yeah, that's a good question. I don't know. Roy Thomas and Denny O'Neill had been, you know, had been the guys who'd come in previous to us, pretty much. And they were the only two. I mean, Stan did it all himself. I once figured out that Stan was writing 13 books a month.
Oh, my.
Before he hired assistants. And those 13 books ranged from Millie the Model to the Fantastic Four, you know, to Kid Cold Outlaw. I mean, he was writing all this stuff. And so he eventually hired two assistants, and Roy, I had not known this, but Roy told me a couple years ago that Stan really wanted everybody to sound like him. And he drilled Roy and Denny continuously about, this doesn't sound like me, go rewrite this, you know, rework it, blah, blah, blah. So then Roy got to be the editor, and for whatever reason, Roy just said, screw it, do what you want to do. You know, I mean, I trust you. And you know, I mean, we understood, I don't think anybody, I'm sure nobody ever said this is a rule, but I'm sure we all understood that we had to sort of sound like we belonged in the Marvel universe, but we were able to do our own takes on how that played out and what we wanted to do with it. And until I heard that, I didn't know how much I owed Roy for that, you know, because the logical thing would have been for him to say, got to sound like Stan, go back and rewrite it, you know? So somehow or other, probably the drugs, you know, if you've ever met Roy, that's a joke. but I mean, somewhere in the early 70s, a bunch of us just all decided we wanted to do comics, and Roy decided we could do them, you know, and it all just came together.
Can you tell us your first meeting with Stan Lee? Do you recall it? First time you met him?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the first time I met him, he was still writing the Fantastic Four at that point. We overlapped by 6 months. We shared the office the office space for 6 months, and then he stopped writing and moved to California and so forth. I got the formal, you know, hi, welcome to Marvel meeting with him when I first came in there. And there was a point, it was obvious. I mean, I knew it at the time. I don't think it was a big, you know, he was clearly playing out the string at that point. He'd written 120 issues of the Fantastic Four and Millie the Model and all the rest of that stuff. And he was looking forward to, you know, to going to California and trying new things. But he, you know, came to me one day and said, you know, I'm looking for a plot for the next Fantastic Four. Can you come up with something? And I came up with, you know, something a lot like what I tended to come up with as time went forward. And I wrote more. I mean, I remember it had the Fantastic Four and it had Daredevil in it, and it was, you know, some sort of thing. And I told it to him, you know, I mean, I don't have a copy. I couldn't tell you whether it was good or bad, but I tend to think that it was sort of similar to this kind of stuff that I did. anyway, you know, so I went in and laid it out for him, and he listened to me, and he said, no, I think I'll create Gabriel the Herald of Galactus instead, you know. And so he did, you know, and Gabriel the Herald of Galactus was basically the Silver Surfer Herald of Galactus, except not as good. You know, I mean, it's like, so he was, you know, and again, having done what he'd done, I'm sure he saw the Fantastic Four as probably more of a galactic epic kind of thing than maybe a Daredevil crossover type of thing. There had been one in issue number 40 or something like that, but I mean, things had grown since then. He was perfectly, you know, I had no problem with Stan. Stan and I were, you know, I gave him an idea. He didn't like it. Fine. And then he left. So I worked for him again in the year 2000 when he was trying to do, I forget the name of that particular company, but he was going to put comic books, animated comic books on the internet. But the problem was that the internet wasn't fast enough in those days to really make the animation work. But I worked for him then. We see each other, not at conventions, because anybody who went to Edmonton knows that he was in a place by himself the whole time. You know, you don't just drop in on Stan.
We've heard some stories. Yeah.
Well, we've heard a story from a security guard about having to clear a bathroom all for Stan once before. So he's Stan.
He's what, 93? He's 90 something years old. And he's still, you know, and he's still functioning. So, I mean, all power to him. I mean, you know, at this point in time, by God, he is Stan Lee. And that means something to a whole lot of people. Okay. So, you know, I'm fine with it. But he was always, you know, I wouldn't say we were any more than, you know, professional colleagues. I mean, we never sat around and had any beers together. We were never in the same place long enough to really get to that point. But I mean,
but you guys were all, yeah, I mean, so many creators, you were all in your early 20s, like you said, and mid to early 20s. He was already twice your age at that point, wasn't he? So, I mean, it probably is a little difficult for, like, I don't know. Is he a father figure? I mean, how can, or is he just, is there any, do you think he got you guys?
I think he did. I think he gets us now. I mean, I don't think Stan has ever gotten old, you know, in that sense. I think Stan is, you know, always, I think he's had the brain of, that's going to come out sounding weird. I think he's had the mind of a 17-year-old, you know, the whole time. I mean, he got to be the editor when he was 17 years old because his uncle owned the company. I mean, it was like, here, the same kind of deal. You want to be the, but he delivered the goods, you know, and he became a professional editor and carried them all the way through the 50s when they went bankrupt and, you know, the superheroes didn't sell and they were down to Westerns and horror books. And then that didn't happen. And then, you know, the Fantastic Four and Spider-Man and, you know, I think he just relates to pop culture, youth pop culture. And that's just a factor in his thing. So I wouldn't say he was a father figure. I mean, he was the editor and he was a nice guy and he was all that, but he was not, you know, out of bemused by what we were doing in any sense, sort of the other generation or any of that kind of thing. I mean, he was plugged in, and I think he still is, you know?
Yeah, when we talked to Jerry Conway, he had mentioned taking over for Stan on Spider-Man and just kind of, you know, the kind of walking on eggshells a little bit just to make sure that Spider-Man was still the way that it was supposed to be. And so it, you know, it's interesting hearing your take on Stan from your perspective.
Well, I mean, you wanted it to be the way it was supposed to be. That didn't necessarily mean it had to be Stan's version, but it had to be Marvel's version. And Marvel by that time had gotten big enough and had enough people doing it that I thought it was, I mean, I think it's perfectly possible to have different kinds of Marvel and have them all fit within the same universe. So, yeah, I mean, I don't know what Jerry was going through when he was writing that stuff, but I don't know. Maybe he thought that he had to sound exactly like Stan, or maybe he just thought he had to make it sound like Spider-Man, whatever that means, you know?
Yeah, no, I think he just wanted to honor him.
Yeah.
That's kind of what we got from it. You know, the book, the Marvel, The Untold Story by Sean Howe,
right.
I mean, it kind of paints a picture of this era, a lot of these unknown facts, you know, that it presents in the stories. And I'm sure some of them are true, and I'm sure some of them are honestly bullshit, because, I mean, you're quoted in this thing, like, consistently. And he never talked to you, though, did he?
No, he did not. And that's the weird thing. I mean, when I saw that book and you know, people were already telling me you're quoted extensively in there. And I'm like, I never talked to the guy. And so I went around right up until actually that Marvel panel in Edmonton, where I said, you know, he got it all from old interviews or something, because he didn't talk to anybody. At which point Tom DeFalco said, well, he talked to me, you know. So he may, and I still don't know. I mean, maybe he talked to everybody on the East Coast and he didn't talk to anybody on the West Coast. You know, I've thought, my father was a newspaper reporter. I mean, I know a little bit about this stuff, and I, you know, and I think if you're gonna, particularly if you're gonna quote people, I think you should probably talk to them. And I do know that there were things said in that book that were just wrong. My impression is, because I think it's a sort of close enough for government work, I put it that way. I mean, I don't think it's just completely off the track, but I mean, I know some things that he said about me just weren't true at all. I mean, there wasn't like he missed it or somebody, you know.
Can you give an example of something that he?
Well, it comes out of the Tom DeFalco thing, because I did an interview recently with somebody else, and they said, well, you know, it says in Sean Howe's book that you got fired off West Coast Avengers because you didn't want to use Iron Man. And I'm like, that makes
used no him throughout.
That makes no sense at all. I mean, I'd used Iron Man was a guest star in the first Beast story. I mean, I'd used Iron Man my entire career throughout the Avengers, the West Coast Avengers. And I was in the middle when I left the West Coast Avengers of doing this whole thing where I was splitting the team into two and people were lining up on either side. I would take any Avenger I could get. I had the Bill Foster Giant Man guy in there, you know.
Yeah, that's right.
So, I mean, it made no sense. And I thought, well, that doesn't make any sense. And that's not why I got fired out of Marvel in those days. Now, who could have told him that? Well, could have been the guy who fired me, which was Tom DeFalco. So, you know, I thought, you know, all right. So he talked to Tom and Tom told him a story and he put it in the book. But he didn't bother to check it with me. I don't, you know, I mean, again, I don't think that the caricature of me in that book is amazingly off, but there are certainly things in there where he heard one side of a story and would have heard a different side if he'd done what.
I would almost love to go through this book. And take everything about you that they put in there, and then bring you back on and ask you if this part is true. Like that would be fascinating to me. I mean, do you want to do that?
Yeah, I'll do that.
Awesome. Want to do that? We'll bring you back and do that. Cause, yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of, like, there's a story of, Shang-Chi that you left it because you were told no more Eastern philosophy. And that's the reason you left the book. Yeah. See, that's a good example of one I didn't think was true. So, yeah, I mean, I think we should do that in the future. Yeah, that would be, okay. I think that'd be a lot of fun.
Okay.
Right.
It'll save me the trouble of having to go through the book myself.
Yeah, no.
There you go. We'll happily take that.
Yeah, because it seems like that's something that needs to happen. Is if you have a book like this out there, a lot of people take it as
absolutely. A lot of people really think that it is the exact truth, pretty much, because there is so many quotes and so much stuff like that they believe it absolutely.
Yeah. What we need is a guy who was there to write the book about his era. There.
Yeah.
Hint, hint.
Now, one of the things that I'll note is that you have a fantastic resource on your website just for going through and reading about your comics and a lot about.
I want to tell you right now how much I hate your website because it's quicksand. Your website is quicksand. I go in there and I was hyperlinked to this and reading about this and that, and I lost way too much time. It's such a good website that I hate you for it.
Firstly, I want you to get more people to do this type of website because it's amazing. It's just unbelievable to read.
Well, people over the years would say, well, what's the story behind the West Coast Avengers, or what did you want to do in that issue, or what did blah blah blah, and I answered those questions again and again and again, and finally, once the internet came along, I thought, well, I can just put those answers. I can put what people want to know up there. I built that whole website myself, which is to say it doesn't have things that move and things that,
Another thing I like about it.
Yes.
It's a straightforward, totally beginning of HTML coding. But that was fun. I liked doing the coding and scanning all the covers and all that good stuff. These are the books, and this is what I have to say about them. I'm glad you liked it and hated it.
I hated that I lost so much time in it because I liked it so much. Let's put it that way.
Because I'm very intrigued. Just to kind of wrap up the whole Marvel element is, especially at the end of. At the end of Fantastic Four, where it just says that that Marvel stopped being interested in creativity. I'm certainly intrigued by that portion, because afterwards I know you worked on Coyote with Epic, and in the first issue of that you had said that, when you left, bygones are bygones be bygones and that kind of thing. So, it's very interesting to see your attitudes and how they change and how much they, I guess, they kind of have to.
Well, in the moment, if somebody wants to take your book away from you, you don't appreciate it. If somebody decides that they want to let you stop being as creative as you have been, you don't appreciate it. And I'm the kind of guy, for better or for worse, who then would just quit and go do something else. I wasn't going to stick around, and I was never a wage slave. I never had the wage slave mentality. I figured, by the time this came up, I figured, okay, I've been pretty successful this far. I can figure out something else to do that'll work. But then, time goes on. Tom DeFalco did fire me. We spent a weekend in Edmonton and I didn't kill him. It's like,
you seem more impressed by that than anybody. nobody's more surprised about this than you.
You don't know how much I wanted to. No. it's like, what are you going to do? I could hate Tom DeFalco for the rest of my life, and a few other people, or I could just, why?
Best revenge is living well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now, in the case of Coyote, I'm really interested in Coyote because I think it's an excellent character and an excellent book. I'm intrigued because you were really at the forefront of the kind of creator-owned movement in your own way.
Right.
So what was it like at that point? Was Epic really one of the only places that you could do that?
I'm not exactly sure about the time frame on that stuff. There had been small companies were popping up for the first time. First Comics, Pacific Comics, Eclipse Comics. People were beginning to say, you know, we could pay somebody to do work and we could publish it and we could make the money and we could do that. So Eclipse, what do I mean? Which is Marvel's? Epic, right?
Epic, yeah. Well, because it first appeared in the Eclipse magazine.
Right. I mean, so Eclipse was out there. There were, I think, First and Pacific probably were out there. There were probably a few others. I'm probably Cerberus was out there, and probably ElfQuest was out there. So Marvel, not being stupid, said, let's do our own version of that sort of thing. So they, you know, so they offered the creator-owned deal. It was still run in-house. Archie Goodwin was the editor. You know, I mean, it wasn't a bunch of young guys in Chicago starting their own company and seeing what happened. But, you know, we had me, Jim Starlin, the other people who were doing that kind of stuff. We had complete freedom to do what we wanted to do, which is pretty much a prerequisite for me. I mean, the flip side of that was it was being financed by Marvel. People say to me sometimes, well, why don't you go out and do an Image book now? And really a part of that is I was always supplied with at least some backing previously. I really would have no idea how to go find an artist and convince him to draw my book for free and wait for the money to come around, you know, on the back end. People do it all the time, but I don't know how to do that. And so the Epic stuff, it was, you know, I picked my own artists, and I ran the book, but it was being financed by Marvel. And, eventually after 16 issues, they pulled the plug on it. So it was different I could have done a book for First Comics or Pacific and it could have been canceled too. I mean, but, you know, there was a little more corporate influence in the Epic line, but I mean, DC is the champion of corporate influence. Anything Marvel did was never kind of, you know, I mean, I say there's more than there would have been outside the big two, but, you know, Marvel was always a lot more loose than DC was. So, I don't want to oversell that. It was just done within the structure of Marvel as opposed to people making up their structure, which I think a lot of the other newer companies had to do.
Sounds like it's creator owned, but not creator owned.
Yeah, you don't have to take care of the back end a lot of, because right. I know in the case of Dave Sim and Cerebus, they were self-publishing, so they had a lot of back end to take care of.
Right, right. So I didn't have to worry about the back end, but it was creator owned. But as I say, since they had the back end, they had some control over it that they wouldn't have had if I'd been self-publishing.
Did Coyote Zero ever come out?
It's a good question.
You reference it through a lot of the earlier issues, and I was thinking because I had read the Eclipse and then I was reading the Epic line and in the columns it's talking about the Zero, which is going to explain a couple of things, and I'm like, yeah, I want the Zero. Where did that come?
Well, Coyote Zero was the Eclipse.
Oh, okay.
Story, Coyote Epic started with issue number one,
yeah,
but there was a story before that, so that's what I called Coyote Zero.
Okay. Okay, excellent.
I wrote the original Coyote story to be done as one long graphic album, and then Marshall Rogers drew it sort of 10 pages at a time, and so it got published as a serial. We had a good time several years ago. Image did, in fact, reprint all that stuff, and we were able for the first time to sort of gather it all together and take out the extraneous pages that were needed if you were starting and stopping every month, and put it back in its original 60-page thing. And we published all the extraneous pages, too, because that was Marshall Rogers' art, and that was cool. Yeah, that was a, you know, a whole one-shot thing. And then when Marvel came around and said, we want you to do something for the Epic line, I immediately thought of continuing the Coyote thing. But Marshall wasn't available at that time. So same character over time, but sort of different circumstances for how he appeared.
Yeah, because I know you had some changes in artists which held you back, and it was interesting reading the letter columns and going through those and just seeing what people thought of the different artists, and as well just the storyline at the time and how your, because I know your publishing schedule definitely suffered at that point.
Well, it did, and Steve Lealoha was the original artist, and then he couldn't keep up with it. And that caught me by surprise. And as I said, I was not used to like finding artists. So it took me a while to find somebody who would step in and draw something. And that was Jackson Geis, Butch Geis, depending on which era you're talking about. but he was just doing the one story fill in. And then I got to Chaz Truog, and I really liked Chaz Truog's stuff. It was crude, and I thought that was exactly right. Crude, but professional. I mean, it wasn't that he couldn't draw. I just liked his art style, and I thought it was really good for this kind of primitive character. It had a kind of, as if you were carving totems kind of thing to the whole thing. But there were a lot of people who didn't like his stuff. It was George Perez was really hitting it big then. And George, for the first time, but I mean, George draws a zillion things with tiny lines and all that, and it just wasn't a style that a lot of people were liking, but I liked it, and that was where I said, okay, I own this property, and I told you, 45 minutes ago about how I tried to keep in mind what the fans wanted, and I did, but at the same time, this being the first book where I could, I could decide who the artist was, I said, this is the guy I want. This is the guy who's showing me what it is that I want to see out of this book. And hopefully they'll come around. As it turned out, after 16 issues, not enough had come around, and there we were. But I was doing things for the first time there too. So I was trying to figure out stuff that I'd never had to figure out before.
Yeah, like hindsight's 20/20, of course, but it's interesting as I read the stuff now, because I read some of it in the 80s when it came out, but as I read it, and I didn't quite understand it back then, but now as I'm reading it, I'm understanding what you want. I'm definitely getting the art style and appreciating it for what it is, and so I'm glad that Image did publish them, because I think it is a really good series that people would get now, whereas they might not have back then.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, story-wise, whether it was inaccessible then and accessible now, or any of that kind of stuff. But I do think I'm pretty happy with it, and I was glad when Image asked to reprint it, and I be more than happy for anybody to pick it up for the first time and see what they think about it. I mean, I'm not getting any money out of it now. If that's not a pitch, for money.
So if we sent you some, you'd take it.
I would take it. And, if millions of people went out and picked it up tomorrow, I probably would get some money. But, I'm just saying, there's one of my favorite series. This is jumping completely sideways, but one of my favorite series of everything I ever did. And I mean, I like pretty much everything I ever did. I think I said that in at least one of those panels. If I didn't like it, why would I do it? But I did a very obscure thing called The Phantom of Fear City for Claypool. And I really liked it. I really liked how it all came together. And that had like musical artists on it too. They couldn't ever find anybody to stick with it. And that's one that very few people even know about. But I would say you could do worse than, you know, go find Phantom of Fear City and see what you think about it, because I think it's pretty good.
You know, this kind of brings up something that, to me, I mean, everybody, of course, knows the Dark Detective storyline, Strange Apparitions, or whatever right. they want to call it. Right. And it's an important storyline because in many ways it brought Batman kicking and screaming into a more mature adult era.
Yeah.
And it kind of was one of the major key components to that. But another Batman story that you did that I thought was terrific that a lot of people kind of never reference, and perhaps it's because it wasn't, I mean, Dark Detective had its own miniseries and it was in Detective Comics, and so I mean it was very visible, but in Legends of the Dark Knight, I think it was issues 109, 110, 111, you did something called Primal Riddle, which is right. something I don't think that storyline with its nature you could have really done necessarily within the books, because you know, I mean, Batman's soul leaves his body and all that, you know, but yeah. here's the story that people, to me, I mean, it's like, are they sleeping on it? Why is this one not talked about more, kind of, when the other Batman story is?
It's a good question. I don't think the artist was quite ready for it. I think I always felt that the art in those books looked more like statues than people. He, you know, there wasn't a liveliness to the whole thing. But that was a very distinctive story for me because I, you know, Archie Goodwin was the editor on that. And Archie was known to be dying from cancer at that time. And so that set my brain going off in a direction where, I mean, that story is about dying and living through it and, you know, fighting your way through it and all that kind of stuff. And the title comes from the quote about life is a mystery wrapped in a riddle, wrapped in an enigma, something like that. That's not right, but it's that kind of, so that was kind of the deal. It was about, you know, I wouldn't say the nature of life, exactly, but it had to do with, you know, that was all the stuff that was playing around in there. And I, you know, the whole idea of Batman's soul kind of fighting its way back through these various people, latching on and then getting to the next one and then finally getting all the way back, seemed very Batman-like to me. It seems like something he would do. So, yeah, you know, I think, I mean, again, I don't know what you guys thought when you were looking through the website and all that kind of stuff, but, I mean, I have done a lot of stuff, and I think...
yes. I know, thought I want to read it all, but how the hell am I ever going to get to all of it?
Right.
Find some of it.
Well... you know, but people get defined by shorthand. I mean, the thing about me, if I may say, when you were introducing me, you said, well, he wrote Avengers and Captain America and the West Coast Avengers and the Justice League and Green Lantern and Master of Kung, you know, I mean, and you could keep going because
yes.
I wrote all that stuff. And I think, you know, at some point people go, well, Batman and Avengers, that's all I need to know. You know? And you know, we know if you're going to start cutting things off, all right, that Batman, the Dark Detective Batman. I did, you know, I did several other Batman stories. I did one. The first thing I ever did was a dialogue job for Sal Amendola. It was a one-shot, Night of the Hunter, in an earlier issue of Detective. Sal had come up with this idea for a Batman story. Sal was an artist in comics in those days. He didn't stick around long. I don't know where he went afterwards. Nice guy. But he was part of that whole New York thing. Everybody was there. And he came up with an idea, and he talked it over with Neil Adams, and Neil gave him some stuff. And then, so eventually, Sal drew this whole story, and then he came to me, and he said, would you write the dialogue for it? And the trick is, Batman never says anything. It's all other people reacting to Batman, but he's silent throughout. So, of course, I soon gave him some dialogue. And, of course, thank God, Archie Goodwin was the editor of that, too. And Archie took out the dialogue, you know, and put it back to where it was supposed to be. And that's a high, you know, for people who know that story, that's a highly regarded story. I'm just a hired hand on that. I mean, you know, I wrote too much for that. And, you know, I should have written less. And, you know, the whole, it's Sal Amendola's story. And it's a really good story. And, you know, people don't really know that one because it's a one shot and it's kind of off on the side somewhere. So, you know, like I said, a lot of books are being published and there were a lot of opportunities to jump in and do this, that, or the other thing. But, you know, I mean, I don't know if you've done it, but if you were to have Frank Miller on here, you'd say Dark Knight and maybe Sin City. And then that's all you got to say about Frank Miller. You know, he worked those two things over time. Me, I went off in all directions. So I'm hard to put in the box.
Well, Brett, did you have something you wanted to ask there?
Well, let's see. Actually, I wanted to split off and talk about your books a little bit.
Okay.
Like The Point Man, when that came out, that was fairly early, and then it was quite a long time before The Long Man came out.
Right.
And it, again, it's interesting because as I'm reading through some of the other stuff, I read both that, you know, oh, The Long Man's coming. Then I read The Long Man's never coming. I'm not going to finish it. And then, of course, I started reading The Long Man, and it's definitely, you know, it's of the time when it was released and has all the references that kind of fill in the gaps between Point Man.
Right, right. Well, I wanted to, that was all deliberate. I mean, not the publishing schedule so much, but, you know, I wrote The Point Man as a one-shot book, had said everything I had to say about magic that I hadn't said in Doctor Strange. There were things I wanted to say in Doctor Strange, primarily about sex magic, that I couldn't put in a comic. So I put it in The Point Man and wrapped it all up, and that was the end, and I didn't plan to write anything else about Max August. And then when I left comics in the early 2000s, I got an offer to do some books for Tor, and I thought, well, you know, what would I want to do? And I thought the thing that really intrigued me was, by happenstance, I had written Max August in 1980, and he was working for an AM radio station, and the Russians were the bad guys, and all this stuff that was just contemporary when I wrote it, but all of a sudden it was a time capsule. And I, that made me think, well, what if he'd been hanging around with a guy who was immortal? What if he'd become immortal, if Max had become immortal in the interim? And so what I really wanted to do then with the later books was set it very specifically in the time frame that it was in. And my theory, which may or may not be about ready to percolate, but my theory was, you know, the first book is set in like 2011, I think, maybe 2008. I can't remember now which one it was, but I mean, it was set in its era, and that's why I referenced the specific rock and roll songs that are playing, the specific world events that are happening, the specific things. My theory was that 10 years after that, people would say, this book is really dated. But 20 years after that, they'd go, that's a time capsule, you know, that's the thing. And so I'm sort of writing it, you know, for all the people of, you know, 2031, in a sense. And then, you know, so, I mean, that was the deal. What happens for a guy who has become immortal? Usually, and the other thing about that, just on the fantasy aspect of it, you know, usually immortal characters have been immortal for 500 years, and they like to tell you how they hung out with Ben Franklin and they did this and that and the other thing. This guy's just, you know, it's just happened within the last 20 years somewhere, 30 years, whatever. And so he's not getting any older. And, you know, looking at the idea that in the year 2100, he's going to be here. In the year 2200, he's going to be here. In the year 2300, he's going to be here unless he gets killed. I had to throw that in, you know, he can be killed, but he's not going to die of his own accord. The idea of coming to grips with the idea that you're going to live for 500,000 years, and you know, 2,000 years if you're lucky. I mean, you're gonna, you don't have to be worrying about, you know, can I finish looking at that weird website before I have to spend my time doing something else? You know, it's like you got all the time in the world. And finally, the other aspect of that was, back in the day, if you decided that you wanted to drop off the grid, not so much of a problem. You know, you move to Ontario and you change your name and you slip somebody $10 down at the DMV and you get a different driver's license. I mean, you know, those things used to be doable. Now, dropping off the grid, pretty difficult situation. So all those things, I just thought, you know, the difference then between the 80s, the world of the 80s and the world of the 2010s, that's what I found fascinating. And that's what those books are about, you know, as he goes forward, trying to make this new life work for him.
No, that's really, and so are you going to be doing another one?
I don't think so. I had a three book deal with Tor, and because everything was time specific, we negotiated with them about when they would publish the books, and then they didn't publish them at those time frames. So, you know, once again, I will say there's probably a million reasons involved in publishing books that I'm unaware of. But it kind of screwed up what I was trying to do, so I didn't, you know, I didn't really feel that I could do what I wanted to do. You know, it all comes back to my doing what I want to do. I mean, I've been able to find a way to do that most of the time, and if I can't, then I go do something else. So, you know, yeah. So, but.
All right.
I didn't expect there to be another book. In 1980, I didn't expect there to be another book. So, I mean, if the circumstances came around, there's, you know, no reason I couldn't continue it.
Never say never, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to bring us back to the comics now.
Okay.
All right. If we could talk a little bit about, you've already mentioned Shadow Man, and I'd like to talk a little bit about Shadow Man and Nightman. Mm-hmm. Actually, I was actually asking, probably about a year ago, I was asking Paul O'Connor, worked at Malibu with Chris Ullman, and now works right with him developing apps and that type of thing. If he knew kind of if there was a connection, because you did Nightman after Shadow Man, and while there is differences, and I know Shadow Man, did you create the character solely yourself, or was Jim Shooter involved?
I created it with David Latham, the artist.
Okay.
No, Shooter wasn't involved. Latham and I at this point I can't sort of break it down as to who came up with what idea, but between us we wanted to do New Orleans. We wanted to do a kind of voodoo, you know, a type of magic that hadn't really been done, get the whole New Orleans thing. And probably it was me who wanted to make him a jazz musician. Because I had that line about jazz is improv in the dark, and I thought superheroes are improv in the dark, and it all fit. And then we did that first issue, and then Jim Shooter said, "Can't go there, can't do that." So that was too bad, because I was looking forward to working with Latham, obviously, and we'd had a good time on that first book, and yet I don't own Shadow Man, and so Shadow Man went away. And it was, you know, 6 months or so later that Malibu came calling and said, we want, you know, you guys that we're asking here to be the founding fathers to create like an entire universe and all the characters in it. And you can have complete creative freedom. And I'm like, I'm down with that, you know. So when I was creating characters, you know, okay, I came up with a group of characters called the Strangers. And the sort of natural counterpart for a comic book writer is to do a single character book. And I thought, well, I'm gonna take this guy who's a jazz musician and a superhero, and he can't be in New Orleans, but he's a jazz musician and he's a superhero. And the other guy's name was Johnny Dark, and so this guy's name is going to be Johnny Domino. And, you know, I mean, I've never made any secret of that, that I, you know, I just took everything that I could take from Shadow Man without getting sued by Jim Shooter and rolled it in. And I've also, you know, one thing that I've learned over time, you can say, I'm going to do a character who's just like Green Lantern, except, you know, I'm going to change one thing. And if you're a real writer, pretty soon that guy tends to go off in his own direction. You can't make him stay just like Green Lantern, because that one thing is going to affect stuff. It's the whole butterfly sneezing, causing typhoon thing, you know what I mean? So I only did one issue of Shadow Man. It's not like I had a lot to, you know, to go over the same ground on. Most of the ground was ungone over. But, you know, Nightman soon enough became very different from what Shadow Man became. And I will just add, you know, they made Nightman into a TV series later. And I had set the comic book in San Francisco. And for whatever reason, when they made the TV series, they said it was in Bay City. But Bay City had a Transamerica Pyramid and a Golden Gate Bridge. And, you know, so I don't quite know why. But the first season was filmed way down by the Mexican border, south of San Diego. And Bay City was a very bright and sunny place. And in the second season, they moved it to Vancouver. And Bay City became a very dark and rainy place at that point in time. It's an interesting story, but a longer story about television between America and Canada and the various approaches and so forth that the two countries want out of life. But anyway,
you know, I just the reason why I always speculated at it, I never knew exactly how much. Like, I always thought to myself, Nightman must have been what he wanted to do with Shadow Man if he had it. Because I remember the first issue of Shadow Man. I mean, there's differences, obviously, the voodoo thing, the New Orleans compared to San Francisco. The, you know, one is the kind of, you know, like enhanced strength and speed and that type of thing. Another one's more technology. But they're both drawn to the night, and they're both jazz musicians with long hair. And in the first issue of both series, they both pursue a woman who tells them they're a big fan of their music and own 6 of their CDs, which to me was very specific.
Yeah,
where I thought to myself, he's got to be doing what he wanted to do with Shadow Man.
Yeah, well, as I say, it went off in its own direction. But I mean, I did that thing back in the early days where I had Mantis, and then she showed up over across town in the Justice League under another name, but it was very clearly her. There are things you can't be too specific about this kind of
stuff. That was pretty specific.
Well, but the number of CDs that somebody has is not too soon, right?
Well, maybe only I was the only one paying attention, but
even nobody could have sued me over that. If I'd called him Johnny Dark or said, yeah, I used to live in New Orleans and now I've moved to San Francisco, that wouldn't get me sued, but it would get me.
It'd get you on the radar.
Probably, you know? I'm playing a game there, you know, it's just like, this is a character that I want to explore. And, there are things I can't do, but the things that I can do, that's what I'm going to do. So, you know.
That's great. I mean, as a fan who was reading your work then, who read The Shadow Man and then read that, almost felt like it was a personal shout out to those of us who were following you, you know, which I'm sure it wasn't. I'm sure it was more you just, oh, I'm just going to screw around a little here. but that's how it felt. So, that, you know, that type of thing I love. We've gone hour and 20 minutes. I'm not sure how much more of your time you have to give, because you are going to come back. We're going to do that Marvel thing. But okay. Rick, did you have any more questions?
I have a burning question.
You have a burning question. Well,
probably get an appointment for that. Possibly the most important question I could have. Did you ever meet Reb Brown?
that's the star of the Captain America movie?
Yes. Yes.
Wow, I haven't thought about that in a very long time. No, I never did.
Oh, that's too bad.
But I did get to go on set with the Nightman thing. That was when I was getting into comics, when I was a fan in that period between in the late 60s, between discovering comics and getting into comics, I went down to D.C., and D.C. had no idea what to do with somebody showing up at their front door. And they said, you want to talk to Julie Schwartz? And I said, sure. And I went in, and Julie gave me a half hour of his time. And at the end of it, he said, on the wall behind you there, there's a whole bunch of artwork if you want to take some pages. So I got, like, original pages from the Brave and Bold Justice League right then and there, you know, which I still have. I've never sold any art that I've ever gotten because I, you know, whatever. But I came out of that, and I said, you know, these guys who are doing comics, they're not demigods. They're just guys, you know, they're friendly, nice guys. And I could do that, you know? So I kind of went through the rest of my, you know, in 20, 30 years going, everybody's just doing his job. You know, I'm not in awe of, you know, I run into a movie star or something at a convention. It's like, you know, hi, how you doing? You know, whatever. And then they invited me down for the filming of the episode, first episode I wrote for the Nightman TV series down in San Diego. And I walked into this, they were doing it in a real store. And I walked in and we're in this room and there's two actors reciting my lines and there's guys with boom mics hanging them over and there's guys with, you know, working boards and all this kind of stuff. And I went, it's Hollywood. I just totally geeked out at that point, thereby disproving my theory that everybody's just a guy. So, and you know, if I'd met Reb Brown, I probably would have done the same thing. But I missed that.
Oh, that's funny.
I'd totally geek out over Reb Brown. You know,
absolutely.
We love those Captain America movies.
Have him at the Calgary show next time. You know.
Oh, absolutely.
Hunt him down.
That would be awesome. Yeah, that would be tremendous.
I think we've looked into getting him on the show. Actually,
we can find a guy.
Yeah. Yeah, who knows what he's doing?
That's awesome. That's awesome. You know, I mean, it was Glenn Larson who did the Nightman series too, wasn't it?
Yep.
Yeah, I mean, Battlestar Galactica, Knight Rider, Buck Rogers, yep. Which was for me, I was like, oh.
Yeah,
Buck Rogers when I was a kid. That was it. Yeah, I mean, that's.
Larson was, you know, he was a real Hollywood producer showman kind of guy. I mean, you know, larger than life. By the time of Nightman, he hadn't had a hit for a while, so it was a little overblown, perhaps for where he was. But I mean, he was that. I thought, okay, if I'm going to work with a Hollywood producer on a TV show. This is a pretty good guy to work with, you know. I mean, he was fun to be around.
Excellent. Well, yeah. I mean, Brett, I don't know. Again, do you have anything else you want to?
No, I think that that will do us for right now. Undoubtedly, when we get off, we will think of like five more things that we want to ask. But
the thing is, I'm worried if we open up another topic, then we're going to take another hour of your time.
That's right.
Easily do that. And thank you very much for being so gracious coming on with us here tonight. And
sure.
We'll absolutely get you back. We'll deconstruct the myths in Sean Howe's book.
That would be fun. I'd be interested in
I think it would be very interesting because you might not even be aware of all those things that are said, right, about you.
Right. I mean, the more various things have been quoted to me, and that's why overall I don't feel like he was way off the mark. But, I mean, that one story was completely wrong. So there may be
others.
We'll have to see what the sample size
shows. Yeah, that sounds awesome. Great. So, obviously, you're steveengelhart.com.
Yes.
And you're not on social media.
I'm on Facebook.
You know, Facebook.
And I have 5,000 friends, but I never post anything. So, if you want to sit there and wait for me to tell you something, you're wasting your time. But I was told years ago, got to have a Facebook page. So I have a Facebook page, but I'm not No, actually, on the ride to the airport from the Edmonton show, I was riding with a guy from Vancouver, and we were talking. And he's, you know, he's 22, and he's on everything, and it's like, I'm not. So,
no, but that's okay. You have that website; people can go on there, lose a couple days, and
that's right. Read all the excellent stories because there are excellent stories.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, winter's coming. You know, as they say on the Game of Thrones, winter's coming. What are you going to do? Yeah, exactly. Right.
Well, if it's Game of Thrones, you're going to get your head lopped off. But
yeah. And do you have anything else you want to announce? Anything else that's coming up, or any conventions you're going to? Any new books or projects or anything like that?
No, I'm scheduled to go to England next summer, but I don't. You know, it's not going to help your audience out particularly.
How many conventions do you typically do?
I don't do that many, and I only do them outside the States now.
Oh.
I've been to a zillion conventions in the States, and there's a zillion more that I haven't been to. But all in all, you know, given a choice between going to Edmonton for the weekend or London for the weekend or Little Rock, Arkansas for the weekend, I'll probably, you know, opt for the ones that are more exotic, like Edmonton.
You know? Edmonton. I mean, I don't know if you know this, but we consider Edmonton to be the Cleveland of Canada.
Well, I was told, you know, used to be the murder capital, which I thought
Baltimore then.
Who knew? Yeah. I liked Edmonton. I've been through Calgary, but I've never like spent any time in Calgary, so I can't compare. You know, Edmonton was, you know, it was different, which is what I like. You know, I don't want to go to the same places all the time. So I turned down a lot of invitations just kind of, you know, as I guess it's a theme throughout all this. It's got to be interesting to me. If it's, you know, if I'm going to have a good time, then I'll go. And so I just. People invite me places, and sometimes I say yes, and sometimes I say no. That's all right. I can say.
Well, we hope you had a good time here. We want to invite you over to Brett's house. He'd be happy to put you up. You can stay for free. He'll cook some meals for you and stuff like that, you know.
Poutine.
Well, poutine.
You betcha. That actually is one of our things. We tend to take comic book writers for poutine, really.
Yeah, actually, that's something when they visit Calgary, we've done a couple times. Some people we've talked
that's
to
cool.
For some very unique poutine. So, yeah.
I wanted to get poutine while I was in Edmonton, and we never hit the right place at the right time, so I didn't get any.
You have a reason to come to Calgary, for
that's,
sure.
That's right.
We'll take you someplace special.
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm really glad that our paths crossed, and I'm also really glad that I was able to host that Marvel Bullpen panel. You've been a wonderful guest, Steve, and I wish you all the best in the future.
Thank you.